This is Mary Flynn sitting in the Blackbird office in Richmond, Virginia with sculptor Myron Helfgott, whose work appears in the current gallery section. Having watched your work over many years, I'm fascinated as to when you decided to try to put sound into it and what sort of came to your mind to do that.
Well, it does have quite the history. The first being, of course, that being a static artist, as we were called in those days, one's jealous about writers and movie makers and filmmakers having this aspect of time. So I always wanted to put time in there, of course, didn't know how. You know, it's never one thing that happens. It's always a lot of things that come together over a long period of time, and the light goes on and you move in a particular direction. So at one point, I did get interested in literature having time from beginning to end. There's a compromise one has to
time
make.
Time or duration or both?
Well, time, you read it over a period of time, so I'm thinking about this thing is not revealed. I don't want the sculpture to be revealed instantaneously, but I have mixed emotions about this. I mean, the power of the whole, the gestalt, when you see something that has that terrific thing that beats you over the head is wonderful. So I'm going to lose that and gain something else. So it was all problematic. So these things are, the ideas are going through my head. I read an awful book one time, and it was John Barth's Sabbatical. And in the book, he had a piece of fiction. Can we say junk fiction? He said, okay. Okay.
You can call it anything you want to.
It was awful. But he had an interesting thing. He had footnotes in it, and the footnotes were, as far as I can tell, authentic. They were real things. So I thought, well, what would it look like if I did a piece of sculpture that had footnotes in it? So then I attempted to do this, did it a few times, and that was kind of interesting. And then, so it was sitting there. When Marcel Duchamp died and he left the Étang Donnée to the Philadelphia Museum and they installed it and I went to see it, it just knocked me out. And one of the things that knocked me out was the waterfall, a little tiny waterfall on the upper right-hand side. And I loved it. So when I got home, I wanted to build one for myself. You know, if you love something, you want to either imitate it or eat it. So I wanted to make one just for myself, my own little waterfall. At that time, a friend of mine owned a bar. And so I asked him, do you have any old Miller signs that I could have and use? And he said, no, they're very hard to get. Can't get them. Okay. So I made an attempt to make one, and it was awful. And then I made a second attempt, and it was awful. And then I put that aside about 6 months later. I said, I'm going to make the waterfall, and now I can do anything else until I make the waterfall. And I tried numerous ways of making the waterfall, and I eventually made the waterfall. And a number of years later, a book came out of Duchamp's notes and photographs he left to have the piece put together again. And there's a photo of the rear side of the Étang Donnée, and there was his projection of the waterfall, and I had done it exactly the same way he had done it, which was kind of amazing. So I had done that, and so now all of a sudden these things are moving. It's moving beams of light projected on the back of this plastic thing. So that's the first kinetic aspect came into the work. Then, oh, what happened then? Then there was slide projections that were motorized, and they would move back and forth and stop. Then I was invited to have a show at the Glasgow School of Art, and I had a very large wall, about 60 some odd feet long, and my first thought was to make this enormous drawing, bits and pieces of paper tacked up onto this wall, and I started doing that, and it got too chaotic, and I had to somehow organize it. So in organizing it, what I did was I used the structure of a book, and it's called, no, a film rather. What's called a film in three chapters and epilogue. So I had four distinct parts. And each part had some kinetic aspect to it, where there were some motors driving pencils, making drawings on existing drawings. And they had what was very much like didactic labels, except that these labels were part of a story. And I actually was telling a story about this fellow. And then we had chapter one, then chapter two goes into landscape, chapter three. That's the erotic chapter, and then four is the epilogue, we wrap it all up. So that was kind of nice. But each station also had a audio component. And the first thing I did, the very, very first audio piece I did, was I was going to ask the viewer psychological questions while they were standing in front of the work, looking at it, thinking these are the kind of things that, that really determine how one perceives the work. And some of them were funny, some of them were serious, and I'd say that I really enjoyed that. So I went to chapter 2, 3, and 4, and that got me going. The most difficult thing with the audio, of course, is audio editing, which is astounding, you know, to be able to do it. So I'm just scratching the surface. And I have this thing coming up where I have a questionnaire with answers, and I have to edit 120 answers, each one in its own separate little file, plus my 30 questions, and I have to move them around, four different people answering, move them around and edit and make it appear as if it's happening at all at one time. I've not done that yet, but that's how the audio got into it. So.
Now, I know you have engaged some friends to write pieces for
yes,
you.
You've written pieces for it.
You've appropriated other work. How do you sort of choose that? What sort of serendipity is what you're looking for? How much are you actually planning?
I'm glad you mentioned planning, because planning, I do plan a lot. I plan, I read, I think, I make notes, I have notebooks full of notes. And then, of course, you get into the studio and you forget everything that you ever planned, what you're thinking about. It's like theory. Theory is wonderful to read and it's part of the artist's makeup, but when you get in the studio, you don't think about theory. You just go to work. There is something I try to do is not have any piece similar to the previous piece when it comes to the audio. So when I ask the psychological questions, I've not done that again. I've worked with a poet and I've given him instructions as to what I would like to see happen in terms of time within this writing. Terry Hummer came up with this extraordinary event that was just perfect. But there are a lot of aborted attempts. I tried to work with Terry again and we both agreed that this thing wasn't going anywhere. So we deep sixed that. I've worked with somebody else that has come in, Dick Carline, who has come in, and I've showed him work and asked him to do a modernist descriptive analysis of the work, and he has done that, and we've recorded it. Other things I write that are fictitious, other things I get off the net, and the latest one, which is, I don't even know how to describe this one, but it's reporting. It's a couple I happen to meet on the airplane going from Detroit to Miami, and I was able to take some photographs of them, and then I have about a 7.5-minute description of our flight and the photos that go along with it. But this is the thing that I found most intriguing, the idea that it's nonfiction. I'm telling things exactly as I recalled them, and I wrote this text the day I met them. And this intrigued me, and I want to do more of that, where I just deal with something and I have some visuals plus write about it.
I'm thinking particularly of one of the pieces, your two German friends.
Oh, yes.
How did that piece come about?
I have this German couple lived just outside of Cologne, Ingo, a novelist, Annette, the painter. Ingo and I at least used to email each other quite a bit. I haven't heard from Ingo in quite a while now, but he's very angry with the U.S. and their foreign policy. In one email, he told a story about his father's 70th birthday, and I happened to be going to visit them, and I wanted to record his recollection. On the way over there, I realized that I have a photo of Ingo and Annette together, and I wanted Annette to say something also. So I got there, we recorded Ingo, and I said, Annette, I'm going to email you some text, and if you can record it, it'd be great, and send it to me. Fine. So what I thought about doing was having, as I've done in many other works before, which is something that interests me quite a bit, is the idea of the criticism of the work is endemic in the work, as many wonderful writers have done. So I wrote a criticism of the work that we're looking at and all my fears about the work, and I wrote it as text for Annette to be saying. So in the audio portion of it, one speaker will be on one side of the work with Ingo's story. Annette's would be on the other side of the work with her criticism. So I emailed her the text, and a week later, I get a reply saying she wouldn't have these stupid things coming out of her mouth, and then she refused to do it. And then a week later, I got a letter from Ingo, and he's criticizing me using the same language I was criticizing myself, but they felt like I was using them, and as I was saying in my criticism. But nonetheless, I've got a woman in Richmond who is a German speaker who has a nice German accent to read Annette's part, so I've got her in there. The one other little thing that happened, which was kind of interesting, those two letters, because I'm the kind of person I am, I copy the letters, I laminated them, and they hang next to the piece.
That's where the title literary criticism comes from, essentially, that you feel that the criticism is embedded in the text that you're using.
Yes. Many years ago, I got a grant from the Virginia Commission for the Arts to do this project, to have the criticism of the work endemic in the work. And I spent a year, my work came to a screeching halt. I couldn't do it, didn't know how to do it, and I had to forget about it. It wasn't only until recently, the last couple of years, that I found out how to do it. Now with the audio, it's much easier to do. So many of the works now have the criticism of the work within the work. You know, I mean, probably the biggest influence there was Fellini's 8½, where Guido hires this fellow to criticize a scenario that he's writing for the film. And even though the criticism is perfect, right on, the movie is still brilliant. So it was a wonderful lesson for me.
Thinking of your work, it's always had sort of more than one layer to it, usually of almost a commentary within a commentary. Just thinking of simple collaged things, or even photographs of photographs. Is that something that's always sort of intrigued you, to be standing in two places at the same time?
Well, you know, again, there's so much of these ideas come from literature. I found the ideas about, although I'm not interested so much in modernism, but still, structure in literature fascinates me.
How people do things. A lot of the writers I know you read are the European modernists, I guess you would call them, rather than this, who are edging toward the postmodern period, but are not necessarily purely postmodern.
Exactly right. So within the work, they're going to carry on other discussions, sometimes about the work itself. Wonderful American writer of The Facts by Philip Roth, who in The Facts, Philip Roth has his first two-thirds of the book as some autobiographical thing. And the last third of the book is Zuckerman telling him how full of crap he is, that how he's lying and misleading. And so it's the criticism of what's going on in the first half. You know, you find it in a lot of the Eastern Europeans. And also comments about the book itself. This wonderful book was Bitov, Andrei Bitov in Pushkin House, where just the nature of the novel, at one point the hero dies, and Andrei Bitov starts talking to you and saying, look, you can take care of yourself and I can take care of myself, but who's going to take care of the poor character in a novel? It's really the author's responsibility, and I feel so badly what I've done to this poor boy. So the next scene, of course, the hero is alive again. and then at another point in the book, Andrei Bitov meets the hero, and he says, I was amazed that he was a blonde. I never thought he was a blonde. And it's just this discussion of the book in the book. It keeps you at arm's length from this, reminding you that you're reading a fiction here, a story, a fabrication. So I don't try to do that exactly, but still have that distance and talk about the work in the body of the work. Show other things in the body of the work. Nabokov has in The Gift the biography of the admiral, I think, inside it. So it's an autonomous object within the body of the book. Mishima does it, Art Spiegelman does it, any number of other people do the same sort of thing. So these are the things I attempt to do in the sculpture.
I'm remembering, too, you also, and thinking of some of the pieces in literary criticism, you sort of burgle your own visage and life to use bits of them too. And over time you've done a lot of odd kinds of self-portraiture.
One of the reasons that Ingo and Annette got angry with me is that when I'm using their pictures, they think that everything ought to be nonfiction. And I try to tell them, no, these works are a melange of fiction and nonfiction all wrapped up and becoming something, a hybrid of these two things. And they couldn't really, I mean, they're very bright people, but either they didn't agree with it or they didn't get it or they thought it was inappropriate. But so much of the things I do, I mean, I don't want to tell the truth. I mean, truth is truth is too boring. You know, so you want to take and expand the truth and make the truth even more true as by adding other things to it. So
how are you going to do that with the straight reporting? The memory is very fishy.
I don't know, because I've only done this one thing. The other thing, too, is, Mary, you know, as much as one plans and one says that that's not the way it ends up. I mean, it's like, can you imagine, some prize fighter who's been training and he's been thinking and he's kind of doping out the fight, and then he goes into the ring and he thinks about what he's going to do. I mean, he's gone immediately.
And the other guy has an uppercut when it wasn't scripted, but then...
Right. But so what happens is you make all these plans, but what actually happens when you get there to actually do it, something else takes over. You don't even think about him. So whether this straight reporting is going to be reporting or it's going to be one of those objects in the cabinet of curiosities that you say, my, I wonder, is that really real? And so we don't know. I don't know either. So we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.